Welcome to CFO 4.0, the future of finance. The CFO role is changing rapidly, moving from cost controller to strategic visionary. And with every change comes opportunity. We are here to help you take advantage of this transition to win at work, drive your career forwards, and lead with confidence. Join Hannah Monroe, Managing Director of ITAS, a financial transformation consultancy, as she interviews key experts to give you real-world advice and guidance on how to transform your processes, people, and data. Welcome to CFO 4.0, the future of finance.
So hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of CFO 4.0. Another exciting episode for you guys. So with me today, and I apologize in advance if I get the pronunciation wrong, is Isaac Strelowitz, who is the partner and CFO at CoVenture. So welcome, Isaac. Lovely to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, because you've had an interesting background. Where did you start and how did you end up at CoVenture?
Sure. Hello, everyone. I'm Isaac. Great to meet you. I attended Yeshiva University, loved it there. And from there, you know, I majored in accounting and went into tax out of school, not because I had some passion for the tax code or K-1 prep, because I realized I wanted to kind of build that muscle early in my career. And thankfully, had an opportunity come up at one of the larger asset management firms, one of the largest in the world, that would allow me to kind of transition away from tax. And thankfully, was given a lot of responsibility there early on. And that's where I felt like I kind of grew up and learned how to best operate funds, you know, see up close what a world-class investor experience looks like. And it was there that I identified that I eventually wanted to lead my own finance team one day, ideally at a fund. The CoVenture opportunity came up and really seemed like an ideal landing spot for me for several reasons, but notably, the team was just tremendous. I knew that the team there was one that I could grow with in my career. Thankfully, my partner, Ali Hamed, the firm's founder, is just a complete package, someone to work with, who's ultra smart, productive. I just had this authenticity to him that I knew I would work well with, and is also just a genuinely good person. And then, you know, we just kept attracting people that had a similar mindset, that were super sharp, you know, mission driven. And then shortly after I joined, my colleague and our COO, Elizabeth Ostrander, someone that I work very closely with, thankfully, and we just have this great, you know, working relationship. So you can't really put a price on having a team that is, you know, both talented, but also, you know, that you mesh well with and just kind of see everything closely. And when, you know, we debate stuff, it's always like an intellectual approach, and we all just want to get to the best place. So was thankful to have that, and something I still try not to take for granted. The second reason I found it attractive was the firm was very much still in its incipient stages, where, you know, you can kind of sense this energy, and that we were on the precipice of creating this new kind of sub asset class within both early stage technology investing and private credit. And I felt like being a part of that and getting on the rocket ship as it was launching was tremendously exciting, and glad to and joining has been one of the best decisions I've ever made. So thankfully, I'm in a good spot.
And it sounds like certainly in the beginning of your career, you were quite purposeful in where you went. You said about, I wanted to get, you know, that knowledge base in on tax, etc. Is that something you've consciously done through your career, or is it just you've looked for opportunities and found them? Like, how did you approach your own career?
It's a great question. I started out really in accounting because I liked it. you know, the concept of debiting and crediting, I believe, was actually like the ancient Egyptians used to use it. And what I love about it as a college kid was that everything needed to tie out. Exactly. If you're off by $10, you're off. and that was something that appealed to me. On top of that, numbers, if this was a sports podcast, I'd be rattling off statistics, do well that. But so I always kind of had an inclination and preference for working within numbers. And what's funny is, I talked to students at my alma mater at Yeshiva who asked me, how do I get into the CFO role without, accounting? And I always advise them, you should, build that muscle because it forces you to have that detail orientation that you need in this role. On top of, obviously you have to know how to interpret financial statements, how to build out a model. All that stuff starts with the foundation of being in accounting. And so from there, obviously there are different paths that you could take. For me, I think I identified that being at an asset management firm and leading the finance function there gave me this exposure to all different sides of the business, right? And thankfully, at a firm like CoVenture, where we have both a venture capital firm as well as a private credit firm and continue to kind of grow out theses, you're really working within the funds, within the management company, investor relations. It's kind of at the intersection of everything and law, tax structuring. So thankfully, every day is just, just different and new, fresh, and exciting. And I feel like being at an asset management firm, we're just involved in so many different parts of the business, keeps it constantly fresh and exciting. And to answer your question on whether or not I was purposeful, I identified that I wanted to be, for those reasons, at an asset management firm. And it just, the CoVenture opportunity came up and I realized that this is potentially something that I could do for the rest of my career. But to answer your question, I think with each stop I was at, other than kind of working in tax early on, I kind of wanted to see how it went and was open-minded to anything.
I think that's really interesting. And I guess as a, being at an asset management company, you do have a slightly more unique perspective in terms of the exposure, not just to different parts of finance, but also, I guess, the investor's view of finance as well and other companies. So tell us a little bit about what's your view on the current economic situation and what's happening in the current climate?
Yeah. I think what was really interesting was how quickly the current climate changed, right? You had this really hot equity market in 2021 and even into early 2022. And then it feels like about, when we're recording this in early June, about 14 months ago, it quickly started to shift. And obviously you can point to the uptick in interest rates across the globe. And I think what's starting to happen is, you're seeing an SVB's infamous, investor relations deck that came out right before that earnings call in March had a great slide where you would, these kind of still elevated cash burn levels from 2021, right? And I think that's been a theme as well with a lot of the earnings calls is yes, top line is growing, but OpEx is still pretty high, though, still coming down a little bit. But I think ultimately just the whiplash of, now the equity markets have dried up and quickly. But these budgets that were set during sunnier times are kind of still in place and now you're seeing layoffs and I think as CFOs, it's hard to really know. We're not in the prediction business, but what we can do, and the analogy I like to use is setting your watch kind of 5 minutes fast and running things conservatively, but not to the point where you're inhibiting growth. I think that's kind of the approach that I take. It's like I'm not an economist. I'm a CFO. I don't really want to be in the business of making predictions. And the other thing is even the people that are in charge of that, right? If you look like Moody's, I believe, had an A rating on SVB like the week before, right? So I think all we can do is try to make sure that we protect the firm as best we can while striking that balance and making sure that we're still investing in growth and investing in the plan. So that's the balance that the CFO has to strike.
And I love that piece about well, firstly, be, yeah, setting your watch 5 minutes ahead. But how do you approach striking the balance between not restricting growth, but also making sure that you're, as you say, protecting the firm? Is there any, is there a framework you use, or, you know, or even just how you think about it?
Yeah. It's the same way I think about it when I go on the scale and if it presents a number that I don't like. I think what I do and what I encourage, you know, the individuals on our finance team to do, and not even on our finance team, but throughout the firm, is to look at the budget and ask yourself, truly, is this a strategic cost? Is this something that if we cut, would we be okay in 5 to 6 months? I always get asked, you know, well, what margin are you trying to work towards? And I would say, obviously, as high as possible, you know, both today and in the future, but want to make sure that every expense that we have, that it's ROI positive. And if not, if we can't defend it, then we should cut it. And it's a very hard thing to do. Expenses are notoriously sticky. But I think that's the exercise, is you really have to take a good look in the mirror. And in this instance, your OPEX budget, and see, you know, what can be cut. And on the opposite end, like, what can we add, right? What would allow us to, you know, for CoVenture, we're trying to invest more in the team. You know, we feel like right now a lot of firms are zigging with headcount, and we're trying to add people to the team and try to get the best talent that we can. We're doing that intentionally and being purposeful about it. So I think it's about identifying what your plan is and how do you get there, and any noise that's in the budget that you can cut. You know, you should always be trying to take an honest look.
And from, in terms of a budgeting approach, so obviously you mentioned how quickly the world is changing, let alone a single business. So what's your philosophy around things like forecasting and budgeting? How often do you review budgets? Do you, you know, is it monthly? Is it quarterly?
Every month.
Your approach?
Yeah, we have a very detailed budget. What we do is we have, you know, for instance, if it's the end of February, you know, we'll have what we call our 2 and 10 model, which is 2 months of actuals, 10 months of projections. It is a pretty intense process over here. And someone who we recruited, Eric Kagan, does a great job every month working through the hundreds and almost thousands of assumptions that we have on, right? Because especially at an asset management firm, it really starts with the underlying assets and how are they performing, and up the chain, what does that mean for the general partner? What does that mean for the holding company, right? So it's just a lot up the chain. And, you know, we want to make sure that we try to get it. You know, I always say we're, you know, practitioners in corporate finance and not clairvoyants. So, you know, if you're at a point where you're starting to toggle with all these different assumptions, like, you're not going to get it 100% right. You want to be able to provide a range. And when we set our compensation budget, you know, at the end of the year, what I always tell them is, this is the range of outcomes, right? You know, these are the assumptions that we used. And you really want to tell the story, right? It's very hard to just provide a, you know, model. In our instance, we have a model that literally has, I believe now 115 tabs. So now we've broken it down into two. And I think ultimately you're trying to tell the story, and the story has to make sense. And based on that story, provide a range of outcomes. And typically, you know, that's how we've approached it. I always say anything above 3 months is kind of like marketing material at that point, right? So I think you have to, just to see, look at last year, right? And when COVID hit, certainly we kind of tore up the initial budget that we had and created a new one because we were entering a period of uncertainty. So I think it's something that has to be looked at least for us. We do it every month. And it's a pretty intense process. And, you know, thankfully, because of that, we feel prepared for various different, situations and scenarios that arise.
Hey, that's a great way of looking at it, to be fair. I think, a lot of CFOs would love to be in that, feeling prepared for what could happen, but for definite.
Yeah, totally. I think, like I said, with setting your watch 5 minutes fast, right? It's part of that includes having all of the underlying, like, and it also requires you to truly understand what drives value in this business, right? And for us, obviously, as an asset management firm, management fees, performance fees, et cetera. But, you know, it all starts for us with the funds and, you know, how much is being deployed, you know, all of these inputs is something that we work very hard on to make sure that we get. both as close as possible, but to make sure that we're still moving fast and not getting bogged down in, you know, minutia.
That's a really good point. I think there is a tendency, especially with budgeting, it can be hard to strike the balance between the detail and the value of that detail, isn't it, as well? So how do you manage that balance? How do you decide what level of detail to go to in your budgeting cycles?
Yeah, I think, you can actually create like a sensitivity table, right? So you could see, all right, what's the margin of error here? If it's, one assumption versus another. But I think you sense it, right? And I think the theme so far of this conversation is being a CFO requires all, this constant balancing act, right? And for me, what I always say to our team here is that, the finance team is always striking a balance in creating the most value for employees, for LPs, for portfolio companies, and for stakeholders of the firm generally. And within that theme of balancing, you have to recognize when you're getting out of balance with, these details that may make a great model, right? You can have all these inputs and toggles, but ultimately, if it's not really moving the needle as far as what the output is, then you are probably spending too much time in trying to, get cute.
I think we've figured out the theme for this podcast already, which is striking the balance. So we'll clock that one. So in terms of obviously being the kind of firm that you are as an asset management firm, how involved are you as CFO in the work that the company is doing with other companies? So do you get involved in the day-to-day there? Is your role primarily focused around how the finances of obviously the asset management firm itself?
Yeah, so I think within our group, right? So it's funny, when I joined CoVenture over 5 years ago now, we were, first a little bit of a larger organization, then we downsized a little bit, and now we're back up to being, we have our high water mark as far as headcount goes. So as that has happened, my role has naturally changed a little bit. But I mean, years ago, I was, really kind of doing a lot of everything. Portfolio companies knew that they always had my number, could always help. I can't count how many times, they reach out to me to help them with their FP&A process. You'd even be surprised at how many people don't know basic debits and credits, very successful ones. So, tax questions, that's also, the benefit of being at an asset management firm with as many portfolio companies as ours that are still growing. It's like, you feel like you're part of their team as well. And they back then they always knew my door, so to speak, was always open. Now it's a little bit harder because there's just a lot more responsibility here at CoVenture. But thankfully, we have people. What I always want is that culture of, we're always here to help. And I think, the reason why CoVenture really grew early on, and it's very hard to start an asset management firm, especially, Ali, as I mentioned, there aren't too many people who start these types of things out of college. Usually you spin out from somewhere else. And that's, I think, just says everything you need to know about the guy. But part of that is like, we often say we get paid not for the risk that we take, but for the work that we do. And culturally, that'll always kind of be embedded within the firm's culture. So as we've grown, now all of that, like the work that we do for our portfolio companies now, thankfully, is kind of shared across the organization. The great thing about growing is as we've continued to add people to the team, it's like that same culture we still have thankfully kept in place. It was something that we were, I think, worried about when we grew from like 10 people to, now somewhere over 30, I believe. We just had our offsite this past week, so I should know. But that's the, again, the, the involvement is something that happy to pass the torch and have the next generation of great CoVenture employees hopefully continue to work closely with our portfolio companies.
And so with those portfolio companies, obviously you are working technically with lots of different finance teams, lots of different companies. When you sort of step back and think about those portfolio companies that you're touching base with, you're helping out, what are some of the things you see in the successful ones? Is there any sort of patterns or trends that you look for and you think, yeah, that finance team is working well in that company?
Yeah. So I think a lot of it kind of has to do with luck, to be honest. I mean, when you were able to raise equity and now that, you know, I think the common themes are fundraising, right? And as CFOs, you know, at least for me, I'm never comfortable asking people for things, right? So that was a muscle that I had to build and learn how to kind of sell the firm. But I think the ones that were able to fundraise at the right time just gave themselves more runway naturally and allowed them to, you know, still kind of invest in growth and not have to like quickly, you know, everybody had to pivot from their plan, but to not do it as drastically and to have, you know, a little bit more of a sturdier balance sheet, I think was an advantage. And then the next thing is just this operational discipline and kind of going back earlier to making sure that your FP&A process is rigorous and that the assumptions make sense and that, you know, it, there's not only the forecasting part, but then going back and looking at where were we off and what is that, how does that kind of inform decisions we should make for the future? And, you know, I think cash for me is always king. I think it was easy to forget that. I know it's a little bit of a cliche, but the ones that really trying to truly view oxygen and cash as kind of like one and the same are the ones that are just a little bit better positioned. So it's a combination. And obviously, you have to have a great product too, right? So it goes without saying. But I think from a finance perspective, it's the ability to fundraise to and to the ability to fundraise involves you know, honesty and I think, you know, people will invest if they believe in you and your product. I know it sounds obvious. So I think that's you know, to kind of move beyond just the technical ability, you also have to have the ability to communicate and to sell. Those are kind of the finance teams that stand out.
Amazing. And yeah, that's a really great summary. And obviously your primary business, certainly from what I've read and what I've seen, is obviously SaaS. So do you think those principles you talked about, fundraising, about obviously having a good product and operational effectiveness, do you think those principles are fundamentally a SaaS requirement, or do you think actually those principles should apply to any kind of business?
With SaaS companies, they obviously have the benefit of having sticky revenues and, you know, low churn, especially now when, you know, during rainy days. So they have that benefit. But I think that these principles apply really for everyone.
Yeah, I can think of a few, maybe a few other examples where they could benefit for some operational effectiveness and some good fundraising right now.
I think it's important to just always keep tabs on the ROI and marketing spend, because especially during these times, you want to make sure that, again, you're still investing in growth and sticking to the plan while making sure that you're preserving enough cash to create the runway that you need for future growth. So it's, again, it's about that balance. You know, I keep using that phrase, and especially during these times.
And I think that's a really good point, because I don't know what it is, but it does seem to feel like a lot of the times that marketing is the first place that people look to cut expense. So is that something you would agree with? Or actually, do you feel like marketing is the place where you need to maybe focus more attention, but not necessarily cut?
I think it's both product and company specific. So for us, you know, we're investing more in our brand, if anything, during these times. But thankfully, we, you know, have the ability to do so. But I think it really depends, right? I think there's kind of within your marketing budget, there's like the kind of the core marketing spend. And then there's like the, you know, the marketing spend that you would budget for in better times. And I think it's, again, kind of company specific, and you have to really know and have a sense of what will drive value. And you know, I think every project should kind of be what's the ROI here? And if it meets our hurdle, let's do it. If not, you know, we should never do something that does not meet our hurdle, but we have the ability to take more risk if the balance sheet allows for it. So I think that's sort of the calculus that needs to be done.
And you talk about ROI and actually really about investing in brands. So what's your perspective on measuring ROI for maybe brand versus performance marketing? Well, you know, what kind of questions do you ask your marketing team to understand ROI?
Yeah, that is a great question, right? Because there are times where it's observable, right? So we know if we do this event or we, you know, if we have a marketing campaign, if you want to call it, and we know what the exact fees are from that will be brought in, then it's pretty easy to calculate that. A lot of it is an exercise in kind of knowing kind of deep down whether or not it's truly adding value, right? So you won't always have the number. Sometimes you won't have you know, the top line, so to speak, for several years. And you have to, again, kind of be honest with yourself and your team on what you think is truly driving value. But there are times where it's both, you have the numerical approach, right? And that's when you have the observable inputs. But if you don't, then, you kind of have to provide a range and do an estimate. And those estimates have to be, what we call an educated crapshoot.
It's a really, it's an interesting piece because I think sometimes, like you say, brand's one of those ones that can seem quite fluffy as an ROI calculation, and it's sometimes it's hard to get to those real numbers, so it does come down to instinct sometimes, which is interesting. I think we in finance, we like numbers. We'd much prefer something more fast.
And I think in finance, we're also, that's a different side of the brain, the marketing side, right? And I think it sometimes is hard to convince yourself that, because some of our more junior members on the finance team, when they first join, or, they want to cut everything from the budget, right? And you still need to invest in growth. And, the one thing that I have noticed in the last 5 years is it's almost a little bit like a venture capital model where sometimes you'll have a marketing event, or for us, it's events with LPs that'll be so impactful that it's like a 10x event, right? And sometimes you try to experiment and it doesn't work out. But overall, as long as you're looking at everything in aggregate and it's still driving value, you should continue to, continue with the marketing program.
Love that. And again, I'm sure there's quite a few CFOs listening. This is food for thought for a lot of people, I think, because it's always hard to manage that. So we talked a lot about balancing and you mentioned SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, for anyone that hasn't caught up with the acronyms, and obviously the challenge that happened in March, I think. Tell me a little bit about how you manage risk within your finance team. What are some of the things that you think about? How do you balance, dealing with the day-to-day stuff, but also taking that step back and thinking about how do you protect the business, from a risk perspective?
For sure. And it was actually, I believe, March 11th was a day where there was a lot of chaos.
You remember it that well.
That's right. I think for us, thankfully, CoVenture was well prepared in this instance, though there's always work that can be done. And I think the goal for us, obviously, as fiduciaries, was to protect investor capital before anything else. And I think when SVB's stock began to decline, that was a Thursday. We thankfully didn't bank there. Even our portfolio companies were surprisingly not overly exposed. We really spent a lot of time that weekend because we banked at a regional bank, making sure that we were well prepared in the event that there was just a run on all the regional banks. That Friday, things seemed like they were settling down a little bit. And then over the weekend, there was just this bad feeling in the air. And everyone who I had talked to, a lot of my colleagues at other funds, close friends, were planning on pulling out all their cash from regional banks into SIFIs, systemically important financial institutions. you didn't want to be the one left behind holding the bag. And even, you know, again, CoVenture was thankfully well protected. We had insured cash sweep accounts, but we just wanted to make sure that if there was anything else we weren't thinking about, that we were protected. And I recall that Saturday night sending around an email to folks on the team saying, hey, I'm going to be opening up, you know, we had 20 something accounts that we were looking to, we have a lot more accounts, but the ones that we were just had larger balances that we wanted to just be extra careful with, you know, basically told them I'm going to be opening up these accounts. It's going to be a fun night. If everybody wants to join, let me know. And I was thankful that, a lot of people just stopped what they were doing and, picked up and joined the fun. And it was also the night here where the clocks had changed. So it was, lost an hour of sleep. And at that point, there really hadn't been much guidance, on what, if anything, the FDIC was going to do. I remember Yellen went on, the Sunday morning shows and just kind of indirectly, I think, caused a little bit more confusion. And then it was later that Sunday night where, you know, we were told that Silicon Valley Bank would, you know, the deposits would be backstopped, and then things calmed down a little bit. But the number one takeaway for me was, you often don't know what you don't know. And this was a case where, everybody was caught flat-footed. The regulators, right? Moody's came out with that A rating right before SVB collapsed. You know, the Fed clearly missed this, right? And, you know, I think what we can do as CFOs is to just make sure that, you know, you have the firm well protected for things that you can't even foresee. For us, our policy now, obviously we have these FDIC limits that we have now, thankfully, where, you know, we have these insured cash sweep programs. On top of that, every account that we have, right, so we operate multiple entities and multiple funds, you know, we're almost at the point now where we have every fund with a primary bank account, a backup bank account, and a brokerage account, so that in the event we need to move funds around, we can hopefully do that relatively quickly. And I think that kind of caused us to ask questions on where else do we have, you know, a disproportionate exposure to. Is it a third party of ours that we rely on? Is it an employee that we rely on? Where else? You know, we often talk about building the cockroach, where if something terrible happens, we're still walking around.
You're still and crawling. Think,
that's right. And in that spirit, I think that cockroach symbol is sort of how we approach risk management. And we try to just look at everything in the firm. If it's internally, where can we create redundancy? Do we have a disaster recovery plan? You know, our banking relationships, our vendor relationships. I think now we're thinking about this stuff, and we always had, but even more so now, just because we kind of lived through this experience where there was a lot of shock. And thankfully, our existing procedures allowed us to be okay. And thankfully, the government stepped in anyway. But you never know. And I think that was the key learning, at least for me. And now I think we're thinking about risk in a way that we hadn't before, just because it's still so fresh. And just the thought of you know, thankfully we didn't, and it never, hopefully never happened. But we were just so motivated to preserve investor capital that we literally stayed up all night trying to open up accounts for this remote chance that we would lose LP dollars. So I think we're guided by that, and guided by this idea of building out the cockroach and this enduring firm. And to do that, you have to always be thinking about risk.
And so if anyone's listening to this going, you know, I've been putting off my risk evaluation process, you know, I need to start thinking about it. What are sort of your top tips for getting into the nuts and bolts of that? Like, what sort of things should people be looking at, thinking about when it comes to risk?
It's the analogy I used because, you know, we thankfully were focused on risk, but didn't, you know, the process now is a lot more formal and, you know, you can ignore going to the dentist, but then you may end up with a lot of cavities, right? I think the longer you put it off, the more that, you know, you can find yourself flat-footed and, you know, regretting something that occurred because you didn't have these kind of robust procedures in place. So I think the dentist analogy, I think, is a good one. No one wants to go. So some of my friends are dentists, so if they're listening to this, if you want to go. It's something that you can't really put off for too long because you just don't know. And we've seen example time after time of either, you know, companies abruptly shutting down because they, you know, an equity funding they thought would be there was not. And you just always have to be thinking about where we overly concentrated, where are the risks in the business right now? How do we get there? What does the time frame look like to get there? And to do it, you know, somewhat regularly, almost like with budgeting. If you don't do it that often, it becomes stale. And then once it becomes stale, it's not particularly useful. So nobody likes going to the dentist twice a year or once a year, but it has to be done. In the same way you could think about risk management, you know, in the same vein.
Love that. And I guess it rounds out our theme today of striking the balance. So we talked about striking the balance in budgets, striking the balance in what makes a good CFO, getting into the detail or staying, you know, looking at it operationally and stepping out into the strategic side. And we finally rounded that off nicely with how do we strike the balance with managing risk and doing our day job. So thank you so much, Isaac. This has been really, really great. And obviously, if anyone wants to learn more about you as an individual or find you, where's the best place to sort of check you out? On LinkedIn, perhaps?
LinkedIn, for sure. I believe I'm the only Isaac Strulowitz on LinkedIn. So you can find me there. I don't post that frequently, but I am very supportive of my friends and colleagues, and I'm often liking their posts. On Twitter at Isaac J. Strew, though you'd have to put up with a lot of the New York Jets and New York Knicks posts. You can find me there. Always happy to connect with other CFOs. I'm always learning. And I tell our team all the time, you know, just because I've done something some way, I'll change it right away if we can find something that's better. So definitely look forward to connecting with anybody who would like. And thank you so much. This was great.
It's been lovely to speak to you. And I'm sure there'll be the odd New York Jet fan listening to this that will definitely connect. So great to have you on the show. And thank you for sharing your insight on striking the balance as a CFO. So for all of our listeners out there, as always, it's great to hear feedback. So if there's a question I should have asked, maybe a topic we should have dug into a little more, there was so much we covered on today's podcast, then of course, please do reach out to myself, ask me questions, and it's always great to get feedback. And of course, like and share the podcast. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time on the CFO 4.0 podcast.
Now, for the 1 million pound question. What is the best finance software for your business? Is it A, Sage 50? Is it B, Sage 200 Standard? C, Sage 200 Professional? Or D, Sage Intacct? An impossible question to answer without a lifeline. But we have the perfect lifeline for you. Our free quiz, which Sage product is right for you? We'll tell you which product is the best fit for your business in just 5 minutes. All you need to do is head to www.itassolutions.co.uk and answer a few simple questions.